Everyone.
Morning.
And welcome to those who are here for the first time. Thank you all for coming out, managing to get up early with the time change on this beautiful sunny day. We didn't do it this morning, but at our regular, because this is our monthly half-day retreat schedule, but at our regular practice sessions on Sunday and Wednesday, we begin with someone making an incense offering and doing a chant or a verse from the Zen tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen tradition. And the last lines of the verse are, "May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home," because we do chronically forget our true home. The 15th century Japanese poet Ikkyu wrote this verse, "My true dwelling has no pillars and no roof, so rain cannot soak it and wind cannot blow it down." Last week, Michael and I, on one of those snowy days, or wet snowy days, drove past Oppenheimer Park. Do people know where that is, mostly? Yeah, in the downtown east side. It's a place where homeless people are living in tents that a year or so ago was completely cleared of tents, and now increasing numbers of tents are there again. And I thought about how, you know, cold and wet it was, you know, for people to be living in those tents. Those old, they're all sort of sagging and wet. And I think EQ's dwelling place without a roof and Thich Nhat Hanh's true home are quite different from those wet, cold tents in Oppenheimer Park. So the past couple weeks, I've been doing some reading and reflecting on home leaving, homelessness, and finding our true home. So that's what I want to share with you today, some of those reflections. 3 weeks ago, we had a priest ordination ceremony for Kakuko K here. Priest ordination is called Shukke Tokudo in Japanese, which means leaving home, attaining the way. Buddhist monks have been called home leavers since the very earliest days, following the Buddha's example, because of course we know as a young man, he left the safety of the palace where he was raised. He left his family, his young wife, and son. After he encountered, as a young man, the realities of human suffering, sickness, old age, and death that he'd been sheltered from, you know, growing up. And he left home determined to find a way to be free of suffering in a life in this world where there is so much suffering, you know, to have an open mind and heart, supple and free from the push and pull of what are called the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Right? We're always blown back and forth between those winds, right? So he went out to find his true home in that freedom. Now, 3 weeks from today, we're going to have another ceremony for 7 Sangha members. It's called Jukai, or receiving the precepts. It's also called lay ordination. And it's called Zaike Tokudo, which is staying home, attaining the way. So clearly, there are two paths. Actually, there are numberless paths, as many paths as there are bodhisattvas, and all of you are each on a path. But these two paths of leaving home, attaining the way, staying home, attaining the way, go back to the time of the Buddha. In our tradition and in our lineage, which comes from Japan, there's not such a big difference between those two paths as there is in early Buddhist, in the Theravadan Buddhist countries today. And here in the West, there's even less difference between the two paths. As Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, who founded our lineage in San Francisco, once quipped, we're all kind of in between. We're all kind of in between lay and ordained. We receive exactly the same set of 16 bodhisattva precepts with lay ordination, with priest ordination, with dharma transmission. Even after we die, we receive them one more time in our funeral. It's a simplified set of precepts. It's not the full monastic precepts of Theravadan Buddhism. Lay people can practice side by side with priests or monks in most practice centers in North America, and some in Japan as well. So lay people can go and do a three-month practice period at Tassajara Monastery, where some of us have gone, in California. And on the other hand, many fully ordained priests are married, and some with children, some with jobs, in the everyday work world, especially when they practice and teach in the context of a lay community like this, here at Mountain Rain. So, Michael and I, for quite a few years, had jobs. Now we don't, because now everyone's contributions to Canada Pension help to support our priest practice, right? So, as well as the Sangha does, for sure. So there are different configurations, right, in our practice and our way these days. For all of us, leaving home and staying home has become more cyclic and more metaphorical. We extend our practice from the Zendo into every aspect of our daily lives, bringing mindful awareness to our speech and action in the world, cultivating an openness of heart and flexibility of mind that allows us to respond to a complicated world and a changing environment with as much wisdom and compassion as we can. So what does home leaving mean in the context of this practice? I turned to Dogen's text called The Virtue of Home Leaving. Dogen is the Japanese monk who brought this particular form of practice from China to Japan back in the 13th century. And he wrote a lot. He left a lot of teachings for us. This one, The Virtue of Home Leaving, is really a kind of compendium of quotes from other sources. He's quoting a lot of other things and then commenting. And so in reading this, I found the legend of when Mahakashapa, the first of Buddha's disciples to be ordained, and received Dharma transmission. Mahakashapa expressed his desire to become a monk and help all beings to awaken. And the Buddha said, "Come, monk." And at that, Mahakashapa's hair immediately fell off. And an okesa, this priest monk's robe, wrapped itself around him. It wasn't that easy, was it, Kay? It was a little harder to get the robe on and the hair off. And what kind of a little bit took me aback is Dogen seems to take kind of a hard line about the virtues of monastic home leaving. He says, even home leavers who break the precepts and do not practice attain the way. And then he says, there's never been a single lay person who has attained the way. I thought, what? Ouch. What about Vimalakirti, the great legendary enlightened layman from the Buddha's time, and other examples? And Dogen even discounts him. I hate to say this, but in this particular text, Dogen can sound a little fundamentalist and discouraging of lay practitioners. So I had to kind of look into this, and I realized that this text was written very near the end of his life, and he had established this monastery, and maybe he was a little concerned, you know, about the ongoing viability of this way of practice that he had established, and so he was really kind of pushing for the monastic life. He even maintains that a monastic home laborer who breaks the precepts is superior to a lay person who keeps them. He cites an ancient text to support this argument that includes a story from the Pali Canon, so the earliest Buddhist sutras, where a Brahmin, high-class Indian, probably wealthy person, gets drunk and asks the Buddha to ordain him. The Buddha has his monks shave the Brahmin's head and put a monk's robe on him. Then the next morning when the man sobers up, he kind of freaks out and runs away. He can't quite handle that he's become a monk. And the Buddha's disciples ask him, why did you ordain this guy, you know, this drunken Brahmin? And the Buddha replies, he would otherwise never have the aspiration for leaving the household, even for immeasurable eons. He aroused a faint aspiration because he was drunk. Due to such causes and conditions, he will leave the household and attain the way in the future, meaning in another life, right? Future life. The merit of these causes and conditions and leaving the household is immeasurable. Thus, holding the five precepts as a layperson does not equal leaving the household. So in those days, the lay people would just take the first five precepts, and the monks and nuns would take over 300, and the nuns had extra ones as well. So this was a different construct and a different era from our own. And Dogen is talking about a kind of karmic calculus that would have been much more easily understood than in our times. Someone asked me about this saying, you know, that even a monk who breaks the precepts is superior to a lay person who keeps the precepts. Somebody asked me about that a couple of weeks ago. It might have been after the ordination ceremony. I can't remember. And I gave it a different spin from what it certainly would have meant in early Buddhist history. It occurred to me that we could take the perspective that the action of a monk who breaks a precept out of compassion will have more beneficial results than a layperson who rigidly maintains a precept in a way that actually ends up having causing harm. And you can probably think of some examples of how that might take. I mean, the classic example is if you're in Holland or some of the occupied countries occupied by the Nazis during World War II, and you are hiding Jews in your attic, and the Gestapo comes to your door, knock, knock, are you hiding Jews? And you break, do you keep the precept of telling the truth, or do you break the precept to save those lives? There are various stories, actually, in the Mahayana sutras of exactly that, of cases of breaking a precept out of compassion, being seen as the bodhisattva way. Of course, we have to be very honest, scrupulous, in fact, with ourselves and not create justification and rationales, but a deep understanding. But if we, I'd like to think that Dogen would support this view in his more generous frames of mind, which he also has, certainly in his writings you will find, and in his very non-dualistic frame, teachings. I think he could support this view. But if we allow this interpretation that I've just given you, we also have to admit that the action of a layperson who breaks a precept out of compassion will be more beneficial than the action of a monk who rigidly keeps a precept and causes harm. It can flip both ways, of course. But I think we do have to admit that the path of lay practice is pretty challenging, you know, practicing in the everyday world without the structure and the container of a monastery. Dogen, another quote that he uses is from Nagarjuna, who is a 2nd century Mahayana Indian philosopher. And he gives us a very typical perspective from his times of lay versus monastic practice. A monk asks him this question. It is taught that those who receive lay precepts will be born in the Deva world, sort of a heavenly world, attain the Bodhisattva way, and experience nirvana. What then is the use of receiving the precepts for home labors? So he's asking if lay people who just take the first 5 precepts can eventually attain the Bodhisattva way. Why go to all the trouble of leaving home and becoming a monk and having to follow all those 300 some precepts? He's asking Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna answers, those who receive both types of precepts become awakened. So he's saying, we can all awaken. But one type is difficult and the other is easy. Lay people engage in various works. If they wish to concentrate on the Dharma of the way, their business declines. If they are focused on their business, their activity of the way, the Dharma, declines. Without choosing one and abandoning the other, lay people need to practice Dharma. This is difficult. Those who have left the household, meaning the monks, can be free from worldly affairs, distant from confusion, and practice the way wholeheartedly. So this is easy. Further, lay people are noisy and confused while being occupied in many things. The roots of their driving forces are the center of all unwholesome actions. That is why lay practice is difficult. Leaving the household is similar to going out into an empty field where there are no people. They can keep their minds unified and free from thinking, and their thoughts inside retreat, their affairs outside disappear. Well, it's true, now as then, that our lives can be noisy and confused. And it is hard to balance commitment to our practice, to spiritual practice, with commitments to work and family and life in the world. It is hard. But we have the great good fortune to be able to practice as lay people in a way that has often not been available historically. And I would even go so far as to say we live in a time that calls us to take this difficult path of practice in the world, because the earth and all beings really need people who are awakening and actualizing their practice right here, right now, even in a time that's as difficult as our present day times are, full of chaos and disorder. Dogen emphasizes the importance of the precepts to home leavers, quoting a Chinese Chan text called Guidelines for Zen Monasteries, and it says, the precepts are primary for practicing Zen in pursuit of the way. How can one become a Buddha ancestor without becoming free from faults and preventing wrongdoing? So practice of right conduct, right speech, all the precepts is central, he's saying. And then the Dogen also quotes the Buddha, saying, the home leaver's speech and actions should be in accord. Our speech and our actions should be in accord with the precepts, and that wholesome awakening is to have a tender heart toward all sentient beings. So I think these points, the importance of the precepts and having a, you know, a kind heart, a tender heart towards all beings, these are points that we can all, even as homestayers, take encouragement and strength in our bodhisattva vows to practice for and with all beings. We've been meeting monthly with the group that's going to be receiving the precepts in a few weeks for discussion of the precepts. And the one that we discussed a couple weeks ago was the precept of not being stingy, not being withholding, but being generous. And so I'm going to read to you a few excerpts from this book by our teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, about that precept. Because I think they give us some hints about what home leaving can mean to us in our everyday lives. So he says, he reminds us that loss is built into the very idea of possession. Possessions are precious exactly because they can be lost. Most of us do not recognize this, and when we experience loss, we become frightened and hold on even more tightly. But if we are wise enough to see that it is painful to deny that loss is inevitably a part of possession, we have a lot of incentive to practice non-possessiveness. We learn to keep a loose enough hold on what we have, to hold what we have lightly, yeah, so that we won't be destroyed when we lose it. We don't have to live in a state of deprivation or renunciation to practice non-possessiveness. It is possible to practice non-possessiveness even in the midst of great wealth. Although statistically it's harder. You know, have you ever seen the statistics of people with great wealth actually donate less generously than people with moderate means? There are exceptions, but then he says the practice of non-possessiveness has less to do with what we have or don't have than it does with how we understand and live with what we have. And then he extends this thinking to our relationships with people. If we don't really possess things, how much less do we possess the people in our lives? The very nature of our relationship to them, if it is a truly loving human relationship, is freedom, even though it may include commitment and obligation. To really love someone, a spouse, a child, a colleague, or a friend, is to recognize that they are not us, that they have needs, aspirations, and lives that do not belong to us, and that we cannot control. Can we appreciate and give of ourselves to them without fixating on what they will give us in return? Can we allow them their freedom and autonomy? Love like that may be the highest form of the practice of non-possessiveness. So that gives us some ideas, doesn't it, about home leaving, meaning not grasping in our daily lives. Those teachings, though, that come up not just in Buddhism but in other spiritual traditions, that we can never possess anything, that home is where the heart is, might have a different resonance for those whose relationship to home is of displacement, banishment, exile, or traumatic loss. Those for whom home leaving has not been a chosen path, but has been chosen under duress, or has been chosen under duress. I recently read this book called Sanctuary, A Meditation on Home, Homelessness, and Belonging by Zenju Earthlin Manuel, who's an African-American Zen teacher in our lineage from San Francisco Zen Center. And she talks about this theme. She writes, those who have had such experiences, as I just mentioned, can feel homeless spiritually and physically, and finding refuge or sanctuary from acts of hatred must be offered along the path of finding our true home. She talks about visiting Deer Park Monastery in California, which is a center, practice center in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. Deer Park, with its tree-covered hills, is a place where prayer, meditation, and song shape the sense of place and bring the visitor peace. It's a true sanctuary offering immunity and refuge for troubled folks in troubled times. Sanctuary, from the old French, sanctuaire, my French is not too good, and the Latin sanctuarium, or sanctus, meaning holy, is essential for those of us who live day in and day out in chaos and oppression, where belonging is never guaranteed. As I walk the monastery's paths, I affirmed in my heart that my true home must have peace. And then I read this other book came to my attention in a complimentary way. It's by Canadian poet, essayist Dion Brand, who was raised in Trinidad, African Trinidadian. And this book is called A Map to the Door of No Return, Notes to Belonging. She says, there are maps to the door of no return, the physical door. They are well worn, gone over by cartographer after cartographer, refined from Ptolemy's Geographia to orbital photographs and magnetic field imaging satellites. So she's talking about old maps of Africa, the unknown country, her land of her ancestors. But to the door of no return, which is illuminated in the consciousness of blacks in the diaspora, there are no maps. This door is not mere physicality. It is a spiritual location. It is also perhaps a psychic destination. Since leaving was never voluntary, return was and still may be an intention, however deeply buried. There is, as it says, no way in, no return. So she's talking about that yearning, that deep yearning to return to a home place that we may have very little idea, image of. And that may be true because Canada is also a land where everyone but the First Nations peoples are immigrants, right? And maybe even of mixed heritage. Is somewhere back there, either recently or quite, you know, back through generations, there's a separation from homeland, and that we carry in us in some way. I've never been to Ireland. Maybe I will manage to go, but I am curious to know how that will feel. Will there be some old resonance in my bones when I go there? Because my family, you know, generations, many generations back. And so I didn't grow up with any sense of that heritage. Zero. I was just kind of a generic American. And I didn't like being an American very much. So here I am in Canada. Yeah. So often there's a real erasure of memory of home. So both these writers trace their paths in search of their true home when there is no true return to the ancestral homeland. Zenju, in this book, describes her search for freedom and sanctuary in the Christian church community of her childhood. The Black Christian church was very meaningful, but ultimately no longer fit for her. And then she explored an African earth-based tradition amongst African immigrants in Los Angeles, and ultimately was too culturally restrictive for her. And found herself, to her own surprise, finding sanctuary in the Buddhist tradition, in her Zen practice, so distant from her ancestral roots, yet offering a freedom from that constriction of the karmic, social, historical, political conditions. She says, in one sense, at the core of sanctuary is the failed quest to find home in the places we live. For centuries, millions have sought refuge from genocide, violence, economic loss, and political oppression, forced to venture into some unfamiliar places. Some have climbed mountains, some have swum the seven seas, others have crossed deserts to save their families and their communities' lives. Millions have been forced to leave when their ancestral lands were destroyed. So displacement even here on this continent of First Peoples, massive displacement. Others have fled refugee camps that have become too dangerous to remain in, leaving generations of descendants with an insatiable yearning to return home. Displacement is an embodied experience imprinted on our bones. Since the advent of nations and boundaries, the discarded have left home and their descendants have sought to find it again. Zenju cites a story from the Book of Serenity, a collection of old Zen stories, koans, where the Buddha and his disciples are out walking one day. The Buddha stops and says, "This is a good place to build a sanctuary." And amongst the company of disciples was Indra, the king of gods. And Indra reaches down, picks a blade of grass, and then he sticks it in the ground and declares, "The sanctuary is built." So the message, of course, and it's a wonderful message, I really love this story, is that our practice of boundless mind gives us the capacity to find sanctuary right here with this blade of grass, in this breath, in this moment. But of course we do create sanctuaries, monasteries, practice centers, even a little storefront zendo like this, where people can come and sit in silence together and pay attention to body and mind, pay attention to life as it arises and passes moment to moment. To do the simple practices of sitting, walking, working, speaking, and listening with care and respect. How simple. And yet it does help to have a place set aside to do this practice, set aside from the swirl of daily life. Because you know how hectic and crazy it is. And then to take that inner refuge back out into our lives, to our families, to our workplaces, our daily interactions. So we set up places of practice in living rooms, in storefronts, and when conditions support, larger Zen centers. And with that comes organization and property and paying rent and financial limitations, strictures, policies, exclusions. And for those of us who haven't felt much a sense of outsider status or exclusion, these restrictions and exclusions can be invisible. But those for those who have, for whom outsider status is the familiar domain, it can be hard to feel a sense of belonging, especially first stepping into a strange environment. We're all conditioned by the kind of intrusive, aggressive, competitive modes of social discourse we're exposed to on a daily business. So it's good to stop and think in terms of sanctuary, what kind of space do we want to offer? Our in our Sangha discussions when we have our annual general meeting and we had some long-term planning meetings and the idea of making a place outside the city has come up. And we thought we would allow some time for those who are able and interested after lunch today to do some brainstorming around that. For many years, I think it's been my wish to create a place of practice close to the earth, where people can come for shorter or longer times to do and live close to the natural world, to work in the garden, to prepare food, to learn from the natural rhythms of the seasons and the weather, and to include within our practice maybe making clay tea bowls, or carving bodhisattva images, or making songs or poems or rituals to express our deepest humanity, really, in community. To include within our practice conscious choices and technologies to care for the earth and the natural systems that support our lives. To include within our practice ways of communicating with respect and care. Zenju says, when we establish sanctuary from a place of maturity, the gateway opens wide. We are tied not only to the elements of fire, water, earth, and air, but are free in time, space, and place. This transformation is dependent on understanding we have karmic conditioning, which is temporal and constructed through our life experiences, but we are also free from such conditioning. A sanctuary within or without, built on such freedom, is one in which complete refuge is possible and true home can come into being. So whether our kind of medium-sized sangha has the resources to tackle building a sanctuary for lay and ordained people or everyone in between, I don't know. I don't know, maybe or maybe not in my lifetime. But it's still worth considering and affirming what those qualities of sanctuary are. A place of refuge and generosity, right here and now, where we can lay down the burden of self-clinging and find our true home. So those are my thoughts for the day. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And let's chant together. May our intention